Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2450. That's 2450. We have a wonderful guest tonight. Her name is Amber Jewell. She's a licensed she has her master's degree of social work, and she's from Kansas. I better put my glasses on, can't see this. She's from Kansas, a survivor of many kinds of child abuse, neglect, and hurt. She spent many years in foster care, of course we do a lot of talking about that, along with being in homes fueled by additions of mental illness, all kinds of things, all the things many times that we do describe on our show. And but she has lived it all, lived it through, been through it all. And her outcome today, what she's doing today, is wonderful. And I give her a lot of credit. Now, we have the telephone number here. It's 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. If you want to call in and be a part of the panel, do so. It's an easy show to do. If you can talk on the phone, you can do the show. It's simple. And quite frankly, the more people that call in, of course, we have wonderful discussions. But this lady here, and again, her name is Amber Jewell. She's a licensed master's degree in social work, MSW from Kansas. And I don't want to read her bio because what I really want to do is for her to tell her story her own way. But before I do that, I will read the mission statement. It says here we have a single purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one, of course, is educating the public. That's very, very important. And that's especially related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem. We know this. It's not just in the United States. It's everywhere. Okay. Number two is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, which I'm big on, intervention, and recovery. All right, that's our mission statement. That's a little bit of what we do at NASCA, and I'd like to put it that way because we do offer so much more. But and like the show that we're going to have in just 1 minute that I'm going to start. I see that there's, another person has called in. This is good. And we're going to have a great show tonight, and I'm going to let Amber start. And I ask that you do it in chronological order, meaning that the people who are listening, okay, on their computers or they're going to be listening later on, they can follow along easier that way, Amber, okay? It makes more sense to them. Like, when did your abuse first start? How did you end up in foster care? Because I did read a little bit of that, and so forth. So go ahead. The floor is yours, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, ma'am, it's all yours. And you tell your story. Go ahead.
All right. Well, first and foremost, thank you for letting me be here. It is a true blessing to be able to share our stories, and anybody who takes that brave step to listen or share or support somebody in doing that is always a big step. So I'm grateful for those that do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It was a long process before I was able to share my story, and it was something that was a healing of its own that I always say, as we get more comfortable sharing our stories and asking questions and learning what that comfort is. For me, what's interesting when I tell my story is I don't really have any memory of my childhood before the age of 8. And those who are listening, I just want them to take note of that, because I will reference that again when I'm done kind of talking about my childhood, of why I mentioned that way, because I do not have any memory of it. However, when I was about the age of 8 years old, I lived with my dad. He and my mom separated when I was 1, and I was the youngest of 6 children. I had 1 biological brother. And my dad had been married 5 times. And a lot of the times, whenever there was a step-parent or a relationship, a lot of his time would be designated to that person. And one thing I didn't realize as a young child was that we were a family of poverty. And so he worked a lot, and we didn't see him a lot. So we spent a lot of the times at the babysitters. And I really, really liked food. I wasn't the easiest child. I didn't enjoy spending time by myself and not talking and doing something. And so a lot of times I would be very, very active, and I enjoyed being around people. I enjoyed getting snacks, but that was a stressor on our family. And so it got to the point where my dad got married his 5th time. And we didn't really get along, and they started disciplining me whenever I would eat something or when they were upset by locking me in my bedroom. I had a really small bedroom, and they would actually, sometimes they would put a key on the door. Sometimes they would put like a padlock on the door. During the 4th of July, it was a firework. About the age of 8, 9 years old, you know, sometimes we have to go to the bathroom at night. And when you're locked in a room, that can be challenging. So I often would use towels in my room. I had a porta potty or a little potty in my room for about a month, but then they said I lost that privilege. I would be watched in the shower by my stepmom, because she said I wasn't allowed to use the soap as the rest of the family because I was too dirty compared to the rest of them. Some of the other things, when I was 12, I had, like I said, I was the youngest of 6 children. I had a sister that they would have give me a bath, and they had to use rubber gloves and a bucket of water because I was dirty for that. But it was very revealing whenever I felt naked in front of these people who would be watching in the family. I also would have to, so I like to take things. I really like to read. I like school mainly because they had a really good breakfast. And I would take things from school, so like books. And at home, some of my favorite things to eat was cake mix. Canned food, I would break it outside, dog food, things like that. So I would get really hungry, and they got to the point where they started saying I had to eat in my room. I was too ugly and dirty because I didn't want to take the showers to sit with the rest of the family. And then it got to the point, because I was taking things and stealing, that my parents had me strip in the morning to make sure I wasn't taking anything to school, and they would have me strip in the afternoon when I got back from school to make sure I didn't have anything, and they would do a hand check to make sure I didn't carry anything. One thing that I think kind of funny when I share this story is I loved doing dishes, and I know some people frown and they're like, oh man, I can't stand doing dishes. Well, I love doing dishes because I could eat scraps out of the plate. And that was until they found out I was doing that. And then they had one of my sisters watch me while I did dishes so that I couldn't eat. A lot of people ask me, well, did you tell anybody? Because this is about the age 8 to about the age 12. And I did talk to people. I talked to my school counselor. And they would get the perception that I was just being bad. And my parents would tell them that what I was saying wasn't true. And so I never felt, even if it was happening, I didn't feel like there was interventions being taken. I did self-harm, and that's kind of how I was trying to manage my frustrations. But there were some good things in it. I liked writing, and so writing my feelings down was helpful. And they told me I had to go to church with Grandma on Sundays so that I would be out of the house. Sometimes they would lock me outside the house. But I kind of liked it on Sunday because I would go to church, and I don't remember usually a lick of what they said at church, but my grandma had mints, and I loved her mints. And so I wanted to go to church for that. So that's kind of a framework of that part. And so when I was 12 years old, I didn't really talk to my mom. My brothers and sisters were very angry at me because I was the thief, I was the liar, and if they advocated for me, they would be in trouble. And so a lot of times they were in on some of the actions. And when I was 12, I had a friend move in next door, which was cool for me because I actually had a friend. I didn't have friends at school. I had police called at me on me at school because I would steal books. And so this was pretty exciting. And when my dad saw that I was having fun that summer of my sixth grade year, he told me I had to go back into my room, and I wasn't allowed to have friends. And so I told my friend that I was going to come over there, and I thought I was going to live there forever and ever, and that was all going to be grand. Because my room at the time, I was still locked in my room, but during the summer, they would take the window out. Sometimes they would lock the window down with nails, and then in the summer, they would take the window completely out. And so what I did that night is I packed up some letters that I got from my mom every month, that's the best that I knew her, and some of my poems, and I threw them out the window. Well, people who've been through tough stuff, I think, realize there's certain things you just don't let go. And those, my writing and those letters were those things. So when they were out of the window, I was out the window. And I ran over at 2 in the morning to my neighbor's house, thinking I was going to live there forever and ever, and it was all going to be perfect. And then they took me to the police station.
Oh.
When I went to the police station, originally they were going to send me back to my parents, and the law enforcement pulled out my records. And all I remember is a picture of a little kid that fell on the floor, and they put it back in the file, and they wouldn't talk to me about it. But then they said to me that I was going to be in what was called police protective custody, and we had court the next day, and that's when I was put into foster care when I was 12. At 11 o'clock the next day, they had a warrant for my parents, and 11 o'clock the next day, my parents still didn't know I was gone. In the house, my room was still locked.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah. So that's kind of the steps where I went into foster care. And there's some great things in foster care, and there's some tough things in foster care. For me, I would go to the hospital quite a bit because I hadn't been able to go to the bathroom for a really long time, so my digestive system was really bad and very painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I got my first home that I got put in was a group home. And I was pretty naive. I had no idea what that was. My siblings, by the way, they did all stay home. My parents got released because they had kids at home and they said it was my fault. They refused to give me any of my clothes. My parents said that it was their clothes, not mine, shoes, everything in the house. And I got put in this group home. I was their first kid in the group home they'd ever had. It was a huge house, pretty cool. I was there for a day or so, and then they said, you know, you need a friend. You need a friend, Amber. You need to have somebody come see you. So they invited a girl over. And, you know, I was disappointed because I'd lost what I thought was my friend next door. I felt like it was my fault that I'd hurt the family and I'd lost my friend. So I was excited about this new friend. One of the things about this friend, though, is I didn't understand what a friend really meant. And so when this girl came over and sat on my shoulder and started moving her hands down my shirt, saying that that's what a friend is, I was very confused.
Sure, you would be. Let me stop you here, okay?
Yeah.
Because what I'm going to do is we have a nice amount of people that have called in now while you were talking. And I'm going to go to the panels so they can say hello to you. You've given
Wonderful.
Us quite a bit of information, yeah. And I'm so sorry you had to go through all of this, you know. And family can be your worst enemy is all I can tell you. They can be good or they can be bad. And when they're good, they're very good, and when they're bad, they're very bad. And that's just the way it is. And I understand a lot of where you're coming from. And you see, the people that call in here, a lot of times they've been through pretty much the same things too. So I'm gonna, what I'm gonna do, Amber, I'm going to open up the mics now and let them say hello to you. Again, her name is Amber Jewell. She's a licensed social worker. She has her MSW. She's from Kansas. And she is a survivor of many kinds of child abuse. And, yes, you are. I'm so sorry you had to go through this. Let me start out with my co-host tonight, who's from Oregon. And she's a gal who wears many hats for NASCA. Yes, she does. And I'm going to open up her mic right now and have her ask a question or say hello, whatever. Go ahead. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, Amber. Thank you so much for being on tonight. I'm glad you could switch from the Wednesday thing. I'm trying to figure out the hunger thing and the, you know, why you were treated that way. You were the youngest of six. So you were probably... your mother left when you were one. So I was just trying to figure out where that hunger came from, you would just have, you know, feel like eating anything. Do you know if that came from earlier in your childhood or anything?
Yeah. So that's a great question. It kind of was a double-sided. Growing and developing, I was hungry as a child, and I was deprived from food, and that was a little bit of a poverty. But whenever I was talking about before 8, you know, this is kind of pulling out of the story a little bit, but when I was older, I was able to look at my records, and what I found out was when I was 4 years old, my father, we had been in and out of foster care many times in our lives, and I didn't know it. And when I was 4, my dad had spent time in jail for physically abusing me whenever I was put in the hospital for physical abuse and starvation.
Oh, my
so
goodness,
it been
girl.
So long for quite a while. How I reintegrated with him, I'm not real sure, but I don't remember any of that. I just kept sensing the records.
Yeah, that's probably good that you don't. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And you're doing okay now with the food thing, right? Well, that's later. We'll come to that later. Never mind. Okay. Thank you for being here, and I look forward to hearing more. Thanks.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for that. Okay. Let's go down to Sharonda. She's from North Carolina. I'm going to open up your mic here. Sharonda, can you hear me? Hello, Sharonda from North Carolina, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, you can? Okay, good. Do you want to ask a question, or do you just want to listen? What would you like to do?
I would like to commend her for being transparent and telling her story and congratulate her on being able to have the courage to talk about everything she's been through. And it's wonderful. Sorry for all that you've been through, but you're more than a conqueror. You're a survivor. And that's a wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Yes,
right on.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing with us.
I'll come back to you soon, honey. We have a panel that's building here. Thank you for that, she makes a good point. We are survivors. You bet we are. We've had a horrific past, many of us. And, you know, so she can recognize that. Okay, we have Mary Ellen from New York. Let me open up her mic. Come on, open up. There we go. Mary Ellen, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay,
thank
good.
You.
Yeah. Say hello to Amber, and maybe you have a question or a comment you want to make.
Yes. Nice to meet you, Amber. I'm happy to join you tonight and share your story. I'm always amazed. You sound very young. The education that some people similar to you have accomplished so much early. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
I'm sure you'll do a lot of wonderful good out there in the world.
I sure hope so. Healing is a process, but sometimes in our work we get that too.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
All right. I'm happy tonight.
Okay, thank you, honey. Thank you for that. And you make a good point also. A lot of times when people go through the abuse that we've gone through, they can't get that far in their education, whatever, for whatever reason it might be. And they take a long time to heal. We have the healing journey, and it's a long process for many people. Other people heal in a shorter time. Other people heal in a longer time. You can never tell. And there's so much more to her story, Mary Ellen. You talk about the things that she's doing. I'm proud of her right now, okay? You'll see. I'm going to open up Joe's mic here, right here. Joe from Iowa, how are you doing?
Hey, Carol, I'm doing good. And Amber, thank you for having the courage to share your story. And I'm just curious to hear the rest of what you have to say tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. So that's who we have right now. People might call in even more as we go along. So far we know that you've been involved with the system, as I like to call it. The system can be very good or it can be very bad. And tell us a little bit about with the system that you were in, were they good to you at all?
Yeah, you know, I say that the system, it didn't save me, is how I say it, but the system taught me skills to save myself. I'm a big believer of sometimes the little things and the little people, little moments can make big differences that we don't realize at the time. Like when I did have teachers give me extra biscuits and gravy, or I saw people at church and in foster care, I had some instances like that. If you're ready and you're interested, I can tell you a little more of my story in foster care. If that's
absolutely, we'd love to hear it.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
So I was talking about being in that group home, and after that friend left, I then had a new foster sister move in, which I was excited about that because none of my siblings would come to. We had supervised parent-child visits, and my siblings refused to come. And so what was interesting about this new foster sister is she identified as satanic, and she would tell me that she wanted me to have an out-of-body experience. She told me she wanted to kill the foster parent, and I was very naive to this. And so I went to the foster parent and was upset one night, and she told me it's okay, you know, we'll take care of it. And the next morning, I had a transporter there to move me to a new home. I'd been in that home for a week, in the time of those two. As an adult now, I probably was going to a lower level placement. As a kid, I was being in trouble for telling on somebody. So I went to a new foster home, and what was interesting about this home, and this is the home I stayed the longest in, this foster mother, she struggled with depression, and she was wheelchair bound. And then her and her husband had a 28-year-old son that suffered with depression that lived with them as well. What was interesting in their home was they had lost a child previously, and so they said that the child's name was going to be Amber, and so they wanted to call me as their lost child. Now, as a kid, that felt very valuable to me. I was 12 years old. I still had supervised visits with my parents, and I felt like I wanted to be wanted. As an adult, I now realize that was probably unhealthy, but maybe to the best of their knowledge. I did do some therapy with my dad. What was interesting with my dad and my stepmom is they kept saying it was my fault and that I'd ruined their family and that they didn't want me back. And I refused to go back anyway. Consistency was I would go to church. The reason I went to church was, again, not anything faith-based. It was because they smiled every time I went and they were excited to see me. That's what I really liked was that consistency of wanting to be wanted because my workers would change a lot. And so that was what I appreciated. I have always liked school, so I did well in school and did some athletics. And so a year went by. I lived in that home. There were some instances where the son of the family, the 28-year-old, would have outrages or hit the table with a bat, and we would hunt and fish, so they had guns, and he would tell us he was going to kill us, or he would put his arm around me and say that he wanted to do inappropriate things. He just didn't have very good boundaries. Mm-hmm. And then I was 13, so a year had passed, and I wasn't going back to my dad, and so they started looking at my mom. So like I mentioned, my mom and dad had separated. She lived in the state of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it, but she was working on an ICPC, so an interstate compact assessment. And they actually did place me with her the summer of my seventh grade year, so a year later. What was interesting is my mother struggled with mental illness of bipolar, and she was married to a spouse that had schizophrenia. And so when I was there, we would have a lot of conflict. She would have outbursts or stay home from school, taking care of her because she was very depressed. And then there would be days where she would stay up all night and not take care of her well-being. And I have a younger stepsister, and a day came where she actually pushed my stepsister through a window. And this was about 3 months after I was in Kentucky. And when the police were called, my stepdad got arrested because he was very upset and so our house got pepper sprayed. I remember the smell of pepper spray in that house. And that mm-hmm. stereotypical moment of a kid carrying a trash bag, that was my moment because I got a trash bag and I went through a pepper spray house. And my mom followed behind me saying that I had ruined her family and ruined her life. And so me and my little sister went to a foster home. It was a tobacco farm in Kentucky for a week before I came back to the state of Kansas, since I was a ward of the state. So I was there for just a few months with my mom and really got to see what that mental illness was that she struggled with.
So she was bipolar, and your father, I believe you said, or your stepfather, whatever he was, he suffered from schizophrenia. He was a schizophrenic. What a combination. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Bipolar. And then schizophrenia with the other one, that's very, very hard to live with. Even under the best of circumstances, that type of mental illness is very hard to deal with. I used to work in at Greystone Psychiatric, so I know. I know how they have their problems. Were they taking their meds? I'm just curious.
I believe he was. I definitely don't think that she was, which whenever I figured this out, you know, that made sense when I think about growing up with my dad, why my dad had custody is my mom had been institutionalized previously. Mm-hmm. And so that would be why I have one full biological brother that he and I lived with my dad, and that's why. And we didn't know that, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've how old were you by that time that you were in Kentucky?
So I was only 13 at that time. That was about the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back after that to the state of Kansas. I was in a placement for a couple days. And then interestingly, that home I was telling you with that older son and the mother, mm-hmm. that struggled, they wanted me back. They kept saying they wanted me back. And when I went back to that home, the dynamics of the home were a lot different. They had teenage girls there. And so the girls would say that they had STDs and that I shouldn't sit on the toilet. They would have parties. There was stealing going on. And the foster parents would tell us that if nobody told who stole, then everybody would leave. And they kept telling me they wanted to adopt me. And I was talking to him about doing guardianship, which wasn't as permanent and didn't require a name change. And they would tell me that they wanted all of me or none of me. And I had to do adoption. It just didn't feel right, especially when an incident happened where the foster dad watched pornography with the other foster girls. And then the foster mom found out about it. And so she threatened to commit suicide. Their son wanted to kill the dad. And so the foster girls and I are like, oh my gosh, are we going to have a place to stay? And we came up with this lie to tell our workers, just because we were concerned of the next home could be worse and we wouldn't be together.
Right. You know how often that happens, Amber. You know, a lot of times you're prepped ahead of time. I don't have to tell you this, but remember we teach people on this show. A lot of times in foster care, children are told what to say, what not to say before time. And in your case, it was amongst each other where you didn't know what the next place was going to be like. You know what you're dealing with now, but you don't know what you're going to go into. So it must have been a very frightening time in your life to go through all of this, all the change and all the things, that the circumstances of each change that you went through, all the different situations. You must have felt, how did you feel? I don't want to put words in your mouth. How did you feel during those years? Were you very frightened? How did you feel?
You know, for me, I think you're right. Everybody feels different. And in the education, I think it's important for people to realize that however you feel in the journey you go through is justified. For me, I felt probably shameful the most. I'm one of those that I internalize it and feel like I did something wrong. And the reason and the root that has helped me heal is I've realized that really comes from this belief that my dad and stepmom would say of, you're ugly, you're not good enough, it's your fault. And so I'd heard that so long that when things out of my control happened that weren't good, I would blame myself. And so that's a lot of how I would feel, is shameful.
Right, so. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So often, you know, they make the child or the children feel like it is their fault. You're getting hit because you're bad. You're stupid. You're funny looking, whatever. They come out with all these adjectives. And because we're children and we look up to them, we're trying to look up to them. They don't guide us. They don't help us. They don't do everything that they're supposed to do. But we then soak in what they say to us, and unfortunately that can last a very long time, and that low self-esteem is just so ingrained in us that somehow we have to find a way to get out of that, and that comes through healing. Let me go to the people here now again. Let's go to the panel, and we're going to start with Joe. I start at the top, and we'll work our way down, okay? Okay. Joe, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Yes, thank you. Hi, Amber. Mm-hmm. You have run into the probably most of the spectrum of dysfunction. It is amazing. The people, the types of situations that you came through, actually made it through, between your father, your mother, and her husband, and just incredible amount. I was wondering what kept you going. You said that you had this, feeling of shame, and that was your fault and things. But what kept you going rather than say, I give up, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
You know, I can't always say. I really think what helped is I wrote. I have lots of poems and things, and so that was very helpful. And it was never necessarily a consistent person, but I always had somebody, thankfully, that wanted to see me. And I didn't, as much as I was shameful about that, I also didn't want to disappoint somebody. And so, like at school, if somebody wanted to see me the next day or was proud of me for something, or and it changed, but those people. And then for me, as I was gaining in my spiritual well-being, which for me was faith, I think that continued to grow over time. But people in those little moments, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is good. That's good. It's sort of like little angels come into your life when you need them or something. So thank you for sharing that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go down to Sharonda, okay, from North Carolina. Sharonda, can you hear me? Sharonda?
Yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
Yeah. You don't have to call me ma'am. Just call me Carol. Hey, listen. Maybe you want to ask a question or something. Go ahead.
What was your outlet that you used to keep you sane when you was going through all this? What did you use? What did you find yourself focusing on, the positive?
Oh, gosh. Some days I didn't. A lot of this that I can speak of was learned over years. But I guess in the moment, like I said, I wrote a lot. I wrote poetry, sometimes very angry poetry or words, and so journaling and stuff like that. I also participated in athletics and extracurriculars.
Very good.
Yeah, and so staying busy sometimes could be very helpful.
Well, that was good that you were able. Everybody was not able to do that.
Yeah.
Coming from an abusive home. That's good.
Yeah,
that was an outlet
the
for you.
Home I was. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. That's good. The journaling. Yes. Definitely. So that was my question. I was just wondering what did you find to focus on that was positive that helped keep you sane, that kind of kept balance. No mistake.
Now that you mention it, I think one of the things was probably my schooling, my homework. I liked doing well on it. Because I liked the affirmation. Like, they would be proud of me for that. So it's something I could do.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Sharonda. It's amazing how many of us do turn to athletics. I became a runner. I just wanted to, disappear, okay? And I was a very fast runner, and in high school, I used to even jump the hurdles. I mean, I was into it. And that would actually help me feel somewhat less stressed. It doesn't take the problem away, but it made me feel better. I felt more powerful. I felt like I had power because I was like flying through the air. I don't know, And then you had your poetry. I had a piano to play. I also sing. I sing. I love to sing. I actually love to sing more than I like to play the piano. But you said something that did something to me, because when I was angry, because I came from such a dysfunctional home too, and all the anger and all the abuse that I was going through, I wouldn't go and play nice songs on the piano. Oh, no, honey. I go play these horrible, horrifying songs, you know, that I thought was, that's how I felt. So I'd express myself, you know, through my music. And then other times I play quite well. But, you know, we do that. So we do find our outlets, hopefully, okay? So I just wanted to get that in there. Let's go to Mary Ellen from New York, okay? Mary Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't really have any questions. I'm just enjoying listening. But I find it very impressive, like, how in tune you were to the abnormalities that were happening around you instead of, like, I think sometimes we have a feeling of this is normal, this is what goes on, but it seems like you always knew things were off, and you had a good intuition that you followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure, but very possible. I think that's the gift we can share as community people, not maybe coming from hard places, to role model to those who are, so that we can teach those who are in hard places that there is something different. And
I'm proud of you. You did well, and I'm really happy where you come from to where you are.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm. You bet. You bet. I agree with you, Mary Ellen. Let's go down also now to Joe from Iowa. There we are. Okay, Joe, you're on.
Okay, thank you, Carol. Amber, what an amazing story. And I think you would agree with me, you had to grow up very fast, right?
Yes.
And I can relate to that. And being, everything was, the blame was put on you for everything. I experienced that myself. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, did you say going to church was also an outlet for you, or was not?
It was, yeah. Because
likewise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, because these people, most of them were volunteers, they invested in us kids. There was no ulterior motive. I wasn't worried about being beaten or attacked or called names. Same with school. But ultimately, those institutions failed me when it came down to it. But I want to commend you. I'm glad you're in the place you are today, and that you continue to grow and heal, because it's a lifelong process, I do believe, when we go through these things. And you are, if I can put it to you this way, you are a light in a dark world in which we live, because far too often, this is a common theme in our country and in the world. So thank you again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Joe. You know, it's a lot of us, not all of us, certainly. I came from a family that was an atheist. They were all atheists. And I was the only one that believed in God. So I was, you know, forget about it. All right, I wasn't going to be looked at in any kind way or anything. But I had my faith that's helped me also. And sometimes I think, you know, we go through so much, that either we become tough, which is what happened to me. I mean, I did turn to alcohol and drugs at one point, you bet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I couldn't handle it anymore. There was too much abuse at home, sexual abuse, all kinds of stuff. And I'd already been through that, and it lasted until I was 17. But the point is this. You know, we either make it or we don't make it, and something has to see us through. And I do believe, like Joe had mentioned earlier, it's like little angels, you know, came down on you and like would give you maybe that inner strength too that you needed, because you were a part of so many things that would have blown a lot of kids away and for good, if you know what I'm saying. And yet you were able to keep standing. So that you have a very strong inner sense of self, today, and you absolutely are a very strong person, or you wouldn't be standing here. And, you know, I can't commend you enough for what we're going to start talking about very soon and how you use your talents. And also, too, she has written a book. I just want everyone to know that also, and we're going to get into that as well. But I want to hear a little bit more now about, so we're in the early teenage years. What happens to you between, say, 14 and 17?
Okay. So I was 14, and like I said, I was back at that same foster home. I was in the eighth grade, and like I said, they'd watched pornography, and so we came up with a lie so the foster sisters and I could stay together. And I didn't have any visits with my dad or siblings at the time. I didn't have any visits with my mom. They would say that I'd ruin their families and no contact. And so it was kind of my family. I was 14, and the summer of that year, so you'll notice a trend in summers have big transitions for me. I actually worked two jobs. In the morning, I worked at an insurance company that a teacher had helped me do, and then in the afternoon, I worked at a swimming pool concession. And I was 14, so I couldn't drive. And the foster dad was a transporter, so he transported kids. And there was one day in the vehicle that he had put his hand on my leg, and it was really high and very uncomfortable. And I mentioned to the foster mom that, you know, all these years before I was eight, maybe there was some type of sexual abuse or something, because some things make me really nervous, and I didn't want to blame him, but certain things I just get really heebie-jeebies about. And she said, oh, it's okay, we'll talk to your counselor, we won't tell him anything, and she was trying to reassure me about that. The next morning, I woke up, and my foster dad's to take me to work, and he looked at me, and he said that I should sit in the back seat because he might molest me. And he said that I ruined my dad's life and my mother's life, and I wasn't going to ruin his family's life. So the foster mom had told him about my concern, and those were some of the most hurtful words anybody had said to me. And I went, because it just reconfirmed what my dad had said and what my mom had said to me. That's how I read that. And so when I went to work, I cried, and they were my advocates that I didn't know at the time that I had. But what they did is they saw me crying, they heard what happened, and they said, that's not okay. And they called my worker, and my worker came, and I was moved from that home immediately. So I went to a new foster home, and this was an independent living home. I was, like I said, 14, and there was like six girls there. If there was ever a point in my life that I felt like I struggled with depression, it was then, because I felt like I had lost everybody and wasn't wanted. We want to be wanted, and so I lost that value of who I was. It would be hard to walk a few feet without wanting to lay down. There were some things that would happen from the old foster parents that I just talked about. Like, they wrote a nasty letter to those foster parents. They would stalk me and come to that town. They would call me by the name that they wanted me to be and ask me to come back. It's just some odd things. What kind of got me motivated to keep going was, we had two rules in that house. We were required to go to school, and we were required to go to church. And being required to do something, to keep going and do something because not only is it a rule, but it's important because you're important, helps me stay motivated. Mm-hmm. So I turned 15, and this is where the story gets pretty good, because I was going to church, we were required to, and I would go around, and I am a person, I always wanted a family. A lot of kids in care, you know, they want to be independent, but there's that desire of wanting to be wanted, and I was more vocal about it. So I would go around and I would ask people randomly if they would adopt me, like at school and at church. And then I got told, that a lady from my church, my Sunday school teacher, would be interested in me coming to live with her family. She was married with two kids younger than I. And it was beautiful and wonderful, except for my dad had not had his rights terminated and my mom had not relinquished hers. And this family lived in my hometown. So remember, when I was 12, even though my parents got substantiated for emotional abuse, physical abuse, neglect, they were substantiated. They never got consequences of time. And I would be going back to that town where there was a lot of rumors. People known me as a stealer, a thief, and a liar. And actually what happened is my dad, my biological dad, called the court and told them that he did not want me in that town. And when I heard that, that was probably a turning point in my life where I finally realized he does not have the right to control who I live with, what my happiness is, because I felt like he didn't have any consequences. And so that was the day I wrote the letter to the judge and was like, okay, this is where I'm going to go. I'm going to do this home and be here. And so we did. They became foster parents. And then eventually when I was 15, they did guardianship. We did not do a legal adoption. Here's one of the things, though, is I faced my hometown. So when you guys are talking about, you know, that it sounds like I've been through stuff, how did I heal? One of it is I went through the hardest thing of facing it, not because I wanted to, kind of was forced into that. And it was hard. The first 3 days of school, I cried because, remember, I have siblings there. I have siblings who won't talk to me. They spread rumors. We had to go to court for a stalking order because they would come to my work. And the third day, my new parents, and so I refer to them in third person as mom and dad. I call them by their name because mom and dad is almost offensive if I say it to them. And
right.
The third day of school, I came home and she said to me, you know, Amber, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can do this. And I felt like it was the meanest thing in the world. But now as an adult, I'm like, that was empowering me. That was saying, just because these siblings are saying these things doesn't mean they're true and you can do this. She was believing in me when I didn't believe in myself. And right. So it was a lot of small steps. And every year got better because I had an older sibling graduate. And so by my senior year, I was the only one, and that was great. And so when I was 17, 18, I was going to go to college. I wanted to go to the furthest in-state college away that I possibly could, right? Right. I worked in school. And then here's where a story gets a point where it's supposed to be the happy ending, but I'm a believer of, life doesn't end at 18. You know, our journeys are still a part of us. And I was getting ready to go to school. I bought my first car, and I started having these things, we call them feelings. I'd had them since I could remember. My dad always told me they were guilt feelings. He would say I would steal something, so I'd have these feelings, like somebody was behind me, and I'd get creepy feelings. Sometimes I would get sick. And he would say they were guilt, because he always said I was a guilty person and lied. My guardian mom, my new mom and dad, witnessed them, took me to the doctor, and the doctor found out that I was having seizures. So for that many years while I was in foster care and before, I was having seizures. And that is where I was talking about the 8 years old and before. We went to the doctor. They pulled out my medical records when I was 18, and they showed me the pictures of abuse when I was 4. And they suspect that I had a head injury from my dad when that abuse had happened, which was causing the seizures. Now, in the state of Kansas, you lose your driver's license. So remember, I was going to go to college far away.
Yeah,
so I lost my driver's license because of seizures. Mm-hmm. And when I was a young adult, a few years later, about 3 years later, the medications didn't work because I had a brain injury. And I had brain surgery. Mm-hmm. And thankfully now, in a kind of an ending to that story of it, is it was a journey. I was angry at my biological dad for feeling like he was still having a pull on my life now. But I went through that journey of anger and continue in that journey of forgiveness and finding who I am and the value of every day in case I don't have tomorrow. And I had that surgery, and I had not had a seizure since.
Well, that's wonderful. That's a success story right there. I actually know people who have had, brain surgeries because they had tremors or they had seizures or whatever the case might be. And believe me, it's far from 100% after having that type of surgery. And that's no easy surgery, okay? I know about that. You've been through so much, Amber, and you know, it's I'm just so taken by you in the sense that you've come so far. You must know Robert Burney, his writings, and it says loving the wounded child within, and it is through having the courage and the willingness to revisit, okay, the emotional dark night to the soul that was our childhood, that we can start to understand on a gut level why we have lived our lives as we have. Now, the story that you've given us tonight is all the reasons why many people, unfortunately, go bad in life and stay bad in life. They didn't get the help that they needed. They end up in juvie. I worked there. They end up in prison. They commit crimes. These people, these thugs out on the street, they're committing crimes. What kind of homes did they come from? I don't know. I can only tell you this, that the story that you have told us tonight is almost a reflection, I'm sure, of a lot of other people who had, you know, similar pasts that ended up not so good. Now, I'm very proud of you. I really, truly am very proud of you. And I know a lot about the system because I've worked it. Now, let's start talking now at this point about, it says here, for 15 years she had worked in a variety of fields, and that's related to foster care, education, mental health, spiritual well-being, and advocacy. She and her husband are also foster and adoptive parents. In addition, Amber is a motivational speaker who speaks with professionals who work with people who come from hard places. She currently works as a school social worker, grades K through 12, as an educator and as an advocate for promoting changes and value within people. Amber works to inspire and motivate others to grasp their own power. And so, you know, so often people don't think they have any power inside. They're just almost dead inside. And the process of hope and you know, towards healing. She has a book coming out in December. Tell us about your book right now. Then I want to zero in on what I was just reading there, and tell us how you use all of your many talents, because I believe you're a very gifted person. I want you to tell us how you use all the things that you went through and how you can help others. But tell us right now about your book that's coming out in December.
Okay, well, originally it was going to come out in December, so I'm going to correct this. I have my website, amberjewel.org, and as soon as I get it, I'm going to put it on there. And I actually think it's going to come out in the summer of this coming year, which might be a little bit better. It'll give me some time to put some information in there. But it's called Finding Hope, The Art of Healing from Hardship. And it's really intended to help people who are coming from hard places or experiencing hard places and experiences to find the hope in the hardships within them, and kind of a self-help step to do that, and how I got there and how it's not easy. It's a challenge. And so in some of that, I talk about some stories of what got me there and some realizations that I needed help. And that's how I get to that point of healing. And being able to speak about this stuff is, I went to therapy. I really feel like being okay with not being okay. And what really helped me as well is, and this was a long, long process, this has probably just been in the last year or so, of being able to find forgiveness. Now, an important thing about forgiveness, and I talk about it in the book, is that forgiveness is not forgetting, and it's not okaying what a person does. forgiveness is freeing ourselves from the burdens we carry with those feelings and emotions. It helps us to separate the people that we are angry at from who they are as people. So an example of that is my dad. I do believe he came from a very abusive home. He had a lot of drug addictions as well. Doesn't justify his behaviors in any way, shape, or form, but it helps me to separate that a little bit and see it as his problem and a struggle he did, not one that I need to carry. And that's
right.
The same with my mom in her mental illness. And those are such healing things. And the value that we can feel as people because of the worth that we each are, because we all, as you've said, have stories that are powerful and should be shared because we've had that power within us. We just have to really dig and remember and find it, that it's there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's absolutely right. We'll all be looking forward, you know, to reading your book. And we're going to get more into now what you do on a daily basis, how you started out, and so forth. And I do, you know, want you to come back on the show. We usually wait around a year, but it doesn't have to be quite a year. And certainly do come on as a panelist. You have a tremendous amount of talents and gifts that you can share with other people. I'm quite taken by your story. A lot of times I can understand a lot of your story. A lot of us can, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're survivors. You know, none of us are unique. But to those people out there that don't know too much about child abuse, they hear stories like what we are telling tonight, like you were telling tonight, you know, and it's they just can't believe it. Like, how can this person possibly be normal after going through the abuse that you went through year after year after year? I understand that year after year after year, and you wonder when the heck is it going to stop, you know? And unfortunately, so often we do feel like it was our fault because we were told by our elders that it was our fault. And you think of all the things that happened to us and it continues to happen. Well, I must be doing something wrong. They must be right. These are the things that go through, you know, kids' heads. I don't have to tell you that. And the feelings of dirty. I felt dirty. I felt dirty because I was sexually abused, all right? And many of us are. So a lot of us do feel dirty, whether you did or not. They were telling you you were dirty, but you weren't dirty, okay? They were just treating you horribly. And that's, not acceptable. Now let's go here. It says here, for 15 years, she has worked in a variety of fields relating to foster care. We know this. Tell us how you, what was your first job that you had? Did you start out in the school system after you, you graduated from college, you have your MSW and your license, and you are working in the field of social work. Did you go to the schools? Is that the first place of choice? What happened with that?
No, I didn't, actually. I worked in some mental health while I was in school with some at-risk kids. And then I primarily worked in reintegration department in child welfare, so trying to get kids home. And I was a case manager in that. And then I became a supervisor for about 6 years. And what is interesting about those is, first of all, that's probably my passion and probably my favorite. The reason I left it was I remember I was working with these at-risk families and these parents, and I would notice some of my triggers. And so I would have a therapist, and thankfully I have a supportive husband that I could talk to as well. And so that would be helpful. And then I realized I'm sitting here telling all these families, and then as a supervisor, other social workers or those who are in any human services, to take care of themselves, to set some healthy boundaries, to value their families and spend time with it. And I wasn't doing it myself. And when I had that realization, I thought, I have to be able to practice what I preach. If I am advocating and helping these other people to do these things, then I have to do it myself as well. And so that's why I left child welfare at that time, was I really wanted to be able to be authentic and true to what I was trying to tell kids and teenagers and families to do themselves.
Good for you. Good for you. You have a very good, strong mind. I like that. I want to go back to the panel here, and I'm sure they have a question or a comment they'd like to make. Let me go to Joe. I start at the top. Go ahead, Joe.
All right. Thank you. Yes, that working in the child welfare area sounds like something that that would have appealed to you, because you've had that experience. And it seems like that was good care that you said need to move to something else. So was that a hard decision to leave, or was that something that you had something else to move to? So it was not so much leaving as going somewhere else, if you know what I mean.
I do, yes. It was hard. It was hard because, like I said, it's my passion. That's really where my heart is, in child welfare. And so I think I felt like that was my only avenue to make a difference. And since then, my knowledge and experience of how we can touch the lives and the workers in child welfare can be done in a lot of ways. But at that time, I didn't know it, and so I felt like I was losing something I loved.
Okay, I'm interested in hearing how that came out with helping the helpers. That was cool. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'm really appreciating your story and appreciating you sharing it. And I'm just very glad that you made it through and that you're helping so many people now. So thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, let's go down. Oops. Okay, let's go down to Sharonda in North Carolina. Do you have a comment that you'd like to make, or ask a question?
Comment. Just want to commend Amber for her efforts to reach out and help others. Because a lot of times when people have been through what she's been through, they don't tend to do that. So that is wonderful to be able to give back and help others. I can
thank you.
That's wonderful. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's great. And what Sharonda says is very true. A lot of times people become complacent. They get their lives pretty much in order. They're able to go to work. If they were drinking and drugging out on the streets and all that other stuff, maybe they've gotten themselves in line. And they feel successful, and they should, okay, all these other things. But they don't have it within themselves to say, hey, maybe I can go out and, help someone. Let me be a part of those people who have the desire and the ability, because, you know, that gives us the abilities, actually, from what we've been through, to go out and to help people, to reach people. So, what Sharonda is saying is quite true, and I thank you for that, too. Too many people just keep quiet. They just say, hey, man, I made it through. And that's the end of that, okay? But let's go to Mary Ellen from New York and see what she has to ask her, make a question or whatever, comment.
Yeah.
Mary Ellen, are you there?
I'm just enjoying the show, and I'm looking forward to hear more about what you're currently doing and your family and all. I'm sure everything is a wonderful story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. And let's go down to Joe from Iowa. Okay.
Thank you, Carol. Hey, Amber.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing thing, Amber, about helping people. But correct me if I'm wrong, you and your husband are both foster parents yourselves, right?
That's correct. We are foster parents, and we have adopted one, and we have one of our own.
What greater gift? I mean, talk about helping others. You're helping these children. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. You're a difference maker, you and your husband. Thank you so very much. One last thing. Other than your website, how can someone get in touch with you? Do you have other platforms like Facebook or?
Yeah, I do. My Facebook page is Amber Jewel Hope. And
Jewel?
Then yes, I believe it has both. Yep. And Jewel has two L's. That's sometimes tricky for people. It's J-E-W-E-L-L, Hope. And then my email is kind of fun. I created a new email because I do love being able to share joy and hope with people and help them find their own hope. And so I have a email, Amber Jewel, J-E-W-E-L-L, Speaks. SPEAKS at gmail.com.
Okay, well, thank you again so much for your time tonight and for sharing your story. May God richly bless you and your family. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for that, Joe. Yeah, I want people really to be able to reach you, reach out to you, because you have a lot to offer. It's just as simple as that. It says here that Amber works to inspire and motivate others to grasp their own power in the process of hope towards healing. What do you do? You're a social worker, and you're working in high school, and you know this kid is really down and out. Maybe the kid is a cutter, okay? Many times when children have been through, you know, terrible, lives like we've been through, they tend to cut, or they become they have problems with eating disorders, whatever the case might be. They're runaways. Maybe they're committing crime. This is what happens to kids, all right, who have had terrible backgrounds. You had something to fall back on, and that was school. Many times, children, yeah. And that was a good strength for you, and that was good solid. That was good solid, as I like to say, because it gave you something to look forward to. You were getting education. It gave you strength. It gave you something to look forward to, and you had people there, teachers, I'm sure, that you were nice to you and appreciated your efforts as a student. And this is all very positive, and I'm thankful that you had that. Sometimes we have people that come on that are just like yourself. They throw all of themselves into their schooling because that's where they feel safe and that's where they can excel. They can learn, they can help others, and they can absorb. And it's those hours that you're in school, at least those are safe hours. And sometimes you're able to, you know, if you're strong enough mentally, to push out the bad, and you're in a good spot at that time. So with a kid, though, that is showing maybe behavioral problems in school, they're acting out, they're getting into fights, that type of thing, and they're cutters and they're this or that, how do you deal with a child like that?
Well, I think first of all, it's important to remember that every situation is different. We tend to people from trauma and hard backgrounds, we like things really black and white. And it's a very gray world. And so with kiddos, a lot of times it's really a basis of relationship, building that relationship and that trust and starting where they are. Don't try, and I would say this about anything really, you can't fix somebody else or fix somebody else's problem. You need to stand with them to help and guide them to fix their own, to equip them with skill. Because we have those skills within us. We have to find that value and belief within us and help people like that to see that value and belief within them. I mean, of course, if it's a safety issue or something like that, I'm going to intervene or call. But probably I'm not going to know it's a safety issue until I have that relationship and that trust with that kid and helping them feel value. You're important. I can't wait to see you.
You know, kind words like that many times is all it takes, you know, to bring a child out. You're all of a sudden you're like their friend, and they actually learn to have a little bit of trust, because we go through life so many times not being able to trust people. because the people we were supposed to look up to and who were supposed to guide us and nurture us turned out to be such failures. It's not we, it was them. So we tend not to have trust. So if you're the type of person who can reach a child and give them a sense of safety being with you and the ability to trust, then you're able to find out from where they come. You might already have you might have thought ahead of time, well, this child doesn't look quite right. Maybe he or she's not dressed properly. Maybe they're too skinny. Maybe their hair is not right. Whatever the case might be, okay? And then that gives you some clues along the way. But until that child actually opens up, and, unless you see cuts and you see bruises, how many children do we lose a day, Amber, because of child abuse and neglect? Some of the statistics say as many as 7 a day. Some say 4 and above. They put it that way to be careful. And that's a tragic thing. And since the COVID, with all the abuses that are going on in the house, I was doing some study before I started the show, but the amount of child abuse has just skyrocketed, whether it be physical, mental, emotional, sexual, it doesn't matter what it is, because they're all together, in the home. You know, people don't know whether they should go out on the street. They don't know whether they should stay in the home. They don't know what to do. And no one knows what to do, not even the experts, okay? So when we have a case like this, then those children who have such dysfunctional homes are more involved with the people in the home and vice versa. And that's creating a terrible problem. I don't know if school's going to open up or what this year. Go ahead.
Yeah, every state's different in how they're doing in the schools. Back to my concept of hope, I never want people to lose hope in what you do. To think you have to fix the problems to make a difference. So if you're one who's working with these kids and making these connections or making that report, you are doing something. Somebody did something for me that I probably don't even know, but it probably made a difference. If you're working with those parents who are at-risk parents and you're helping them get their food so they're not extra angry and irritable or teaching them, that's great. If you're helping the workers, because we're short all over the United States on workers in child welfare, many who carry their own burdens that they need healing in, if you are encouraging them, if you're advocating for their pay, if you are helping them learn to set boundaries and take breaks, whatever avenue you're helping the people in the system, you're doing something to help those kids and protect.
That's exactly
why you have this radio right here and the group of you that I've learned about doing this. I mean, you're playing an essential role. Sometimes we just don't realize how impactful it can be.
Well, it is nice to hear that. Many times we do receive emails and we don't know who's listening. Blog Talk knows and how many people are listening. And then sometimes we find out, and we do have a scale that we can look at. But we have received letters from people where they have said thank you. And that makes what we do all worthwhile, because we're reaching out trying to help. We don't get paid for doing this. We are a 501c3. We do ask the people, send a donation if they can, for God's sake, because like all the many, and you know what I'm going to say by all the handouts that we hand out to people, we do that all on our own. There's no one to pay us. But my pay for all of this, truly, is knowing that we do help, that what we're doing here as a show, okay, is reaching people. And that we are able to help. When we have talented guests on, such as yourself, okay, people who have been through it all, who have experienced, many times I have to go over and help professors and teach them about child abuse at colleges. I've been asked many times because I know I've walked the walk. And so have you, and you have all of this knowledge. So we're able to teach, those that need to learn about child abuse. Now we need to get people to care more about child abuse, you know, to in our communities. I do know that from what I've been taught and well, the reading that I do, that every fourth or fifth house down, there's some kind of something happening. It can be anything. It can be neglect. It can be physical abuse. It can be mental, emotional. It can be sexual. Approximately in an urban area, okay? And we've also found this out, too, that it's not just in urban areas. People think that in the suburbs, oh, it's so much better. In some ways, yes, it is. The crime rates are not quite as high. No, they're not. However, the abuse still goes on because you have those people who can shine on the outside. And then when they go inside, oh, my God, where can I run and hide? Mommy's home or daddy's home. Oh, no. You know?
Yeah.
So there's that all that type of thing that, you know, that we learn as we go along. And in the foster care system that we were speaking about earlier, they, too, are told, the children are told, this is what you say, this is what you don't say. You put on this dress, you put on these pair of pants, whether it's boys or girls or whatever. And when the worker comes in, and I believe more education has to be given to those that do work in the system, that check up on the foster care, I think they should be able to take the children aside and speak to them. And if they're taught well enough, okay, they can see flinching, they can see this, they can see eyes that are darting left and right to see if they're being heard, things that you can look for, that maybe things aren't quite as good as it appears because they happen to be clean that day, okay? They have a nice dress on or a nice pair of pants or whatever the case might be. Because foster care is a tricky thing. I think it's very much needed. When I was a kid, I wished I had been given up rather than go through what I went through at home. I wish that I could say that all foster care is wonderful. That's not always the case. You know this. I know this. And yet there are those out there who are foster parents who are wonderful, who are very good.
Absolutely.
I'll mention this. Yeah, we had this man on. We have a couple minutes here before I turn it over to you. But we had this guy on from Keyport, New Jersey. I like to mention him once in a while. I might have him back on again if it's all right with Bill. But he was a foster parent, he and his wife. And they happened to be good foster parents. And over the years, they had fostered, I think it was around 35 children over the many years, okay? They're too old now. Now they go across the street and they teach people how to become foster parents. And I think that's wonderful that he's working out of a school. And you know you've done a good job as a foster parent. This is something that he told me, is if some of those children come back and visit you. If they come back and visit you and send you birthday cards or Christmas cards or whatever the case might be, then you know as a foster parent you did a good job and you helped maybe shape the life of that child.
Absolutely.
And so, yes. So you being in so many foster care, different programs, you saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's what I like to call it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And but still you had the strength, okay, inside. You're a very strong person, Amber, and you turned out very well. And you have a very lucky husband, and you have, you know, you're both very lucky because now you're foster parents and adoptive parents also. Is that correct? Yes.
That's cool. Yes. Yep.
And that's wonderful. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's been a journey, too. You know, we never stop learning, and we never stop growing. I used to think I was supposed to hit that point, and there is no point. You know, we keep growing into the better versions of ourselves. And the motto I go by and in which I do a lot of my trainings is the concept that life is tough, because I think a lot of times we think that it's supposed to be easy, but even adulthood, you know, life in itself, there's just tough decisions. There's tough things, but so are we. Just as life is tough, we are tough. We are equipped to be tough. And we can build on that no matter what stage of life we're in.
That's right. In fact, the bottom of your bio has right here, life is tough, but so are you.
Yep.
And that's right. And, you know, unfortunately, so many of us don't know that, okay, because we've been too beaten down and we weren't able to pull ourselves up by, you know, the shoestrap, the bootstraps, as you were talking about earlier, as you're speaking about, that person did you a favor, okay, because sometimes there's a time to coddle, okay, a child, and then other times there's a time to be a little bit firm, not, you know, in a sense where you're building them up. You're building them up. That's what you're doing. You can do it. You can do it.
And you know, that's,
yeah.
That's a great point. And that's one thing I think about with some of my, I have siblings and my dad just growing up, is I came to that thought of, man, he would say things like, I grew up in an abusive home, and try to justify that as his behavior. And I learned when I became a parent of an infant that I have to catch myself and make a decision in that moment that's different than his. I have to have that desire to do different, because I don't want to say the same thing he does, that, well, my parents did it and I will. I'm going to make that commitment to myself to work towards being different, and it can be work.
And that's a very good mind to be able to do that. I saw a movie once years ago, which is what I fashioned my book after, and it was called Stand By Me. And Richard Dreyfuss, yeah, a lot of people loved that movie. He was the narrator and all this other stuff, and the author and all everything. And every once in a while, he would stop in the middle of a scene, okay, happening in the movie, and he'd say, if I ever have children, I will never do this to them, okay, or I will never treat them like that, okay. So that happened several times throughout the movie, and I thought, how smart.
Yeah.
And I think you're very smart. I want to thank you so much for being on this show tonight. I think we have about 2 minutes. My clock is a little off on my computer, so I always say to Joe at the end, Joe, what time is it? Let's see. Let me open up our mic. That'd be a good idea. Joe, what time is it?
You have about 2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes. Okay, thank you. So, but anyway, thank you so much for coming on. And
thank you.
I think probably the last thing that you would say is there's hope. There's hope for everyone. I'm not going to put those words. Go ahead and say it. Tell people.
There is hope. There is hope for each and every one of you, each and every one of us, because you are tough. You are tough, and you are of value and 100% worth for everything. So I believe it, you believe it, and then work towards it.
Right.
I'm so thankful to get to do this. So.
Well, I think you are a pleasure. You are a pleasure. And please do call in whenever you feel like it. You have our telephone number here, the 646-595-2118 number. And you know what time to call in, because, you know, we can always use people on the panel. And you have so much to give to people and such good advice and so forth. And you've been through the walk. You've walked it, and you can talk it, okay? And that's very, very important. It's good to have book learning, and we have this. But it's also good to have been through it. I hate to put it that way, but you know what I mean, in order to teach and reach other people. Yeah. So, anyway, everyone, I'm going to have everyone say goodnight to you all at the same time. Because we only have 90 seconds. Okay, everybody, 1, 2, 3. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Amber.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. And you are now a part of the NASCA family, and you call in anytime you want.
Woo-hoo.
Okay?
Welcome.
Okay. Thank you so much. Good night. God bless everyone. Stay safe. I don't know whether to tell you to stay outside or inside, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. But anyway, we'll be back again, okay, on Monday. Good night now.
Good night.
Good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten.
Okay.